Democrats don't like the new GOP American Health Care Act. AARP has come out against the bill. The American Medical Association is concerned millions of Americans will lose coverage and benefits, and even some conservative Republicans don't like the bill. Congressman Darren LaHood serves the 18th District in Illinois. Congressman, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Willis, great to be with you and your listeners today.
We'll also talk about President Trump's unfounded allegation that former President Obama committed a felony by illegally wiretapping him, and the continuing revelations about the Trump campaign had repeated contacts with the Russian government or Russian intelligence. Those topics will come later. Let's start with the House plan to replace the Affordable Care Act. Are you supporting the American Health Care Act as it's written?
Well, I think it's a first step in the process, Willis, of healthcare. I mean, this is a complicated, nuanced issue. I was not in Congress when the Affordable Care Act was passed or when Obamacare was passed some 6-7 years ago. But I do know this. If we do nothing in Congress, Obamacare will fail. Now, that's just not my opinion. That's the opinion of Democrats and Republicans and independents. So, knowing that it will fail if we do nothing, we have to fix Obamacare. And so I think this is a good first step, but there is a long ways to go in terms of fixing Obamacare. There are some things that I think are good to keep in there, but there are other things that I think we need to change. And so that's what I'll be looking for as this open, transparent process continues in the House of Representatives.
What are the important things to keep in there?
Yeah, well, I would make a couple observations, Willis. One is being able to keep your children on their parents' insurance till 25 or 26 is a good thing. I think that has to stay in there, and that's in this plan that was introduced last week. I think not being allowed to discriminate against pre-existing conditions is in this bill, and I think that is a good thing also. So those are a couple things that I think need to remain in whatever plan we put forward.
And what are the things about this particular proposal that you don't particularly like?
Well, I think there's a number of things that I think we have to look at. First of all, we have to bring competition into the marketplace. In my district, Willis, I represent 710,000 people in central and west central Illinois, many of those in Bloomington Normal. The number one complaint I get in my office over the last 2 years has been healthcare has gone up exponentially. So in my district, 55% premium increases have gone up over the last 3 years. Deductibles are way too high. And if you remember the promises that were made with Obamacare, you're going to be able to keep your doctor. That hasn't happened. You're going to have lower cost of healthcare. That hasn't happened. You're going to have a lot more healthcare options. That hasn't happened. So we have to fix the high cost of healthcare. And I think you do that by bringing in the private sector, more competition, and figuring out from a public policy standpoint how you do that the right way. I think one of the things that we're going to look at, not in this bill, but in the next phase of healthcare reform, being able to go across state lines for insurance. You should have options when it comes to healthcare. In my district, I have 19 counties. In many of the counties, Willis, you only have one healthcare option, one insurance company to go to. That is not the original intent of Obamacare. Being able to go across state lines so you can look at a plan from Florida or Texas or Missouri or Iowa or Illinois, those options, that kind of competition will help drive down costs. And that's really what we have to do. Small and medium-sized businesses, they complain every single day with the high cost of health care. So that has to change as part of this plan. The other thing that I would mention, when we look at Medicaid, Medicaid was originally intended as a program that, you know, helped fund health care for poor women and children. And we should do that. That's what the program set up for, is to help those individuals. Since Bill Clinton was president, Willis, Medicaid has tripled in this country. So now you have able-bodied working men that can qualify for Medicaid in some instances. I think we have to get back to the original intent of Medicaid, and that's a controversial issue, but we are on the hook as taxpayers for Medicaid, and I think there's a better way to look at how we can reform that program, make it more effective, efficient, and accountable. And with everything in government, we should be looking at, again, how you can make it a better system and revise it. And that's what I'll be looking at.
Well, cost savings is one thing, but the Congressional Budget Office estimates that 14 million people are going to lose their health care if this bill goes into effect. And by 2026, 24 million won't be insured. So no matter how much it costs, if people are losing their health care, how is that any better?
Well, if you look at our, this plan that was put forth, it doesn't have the mandate in there for young people. What one complaint that we heard is young people that are out of college and healthy are mandated or they're fined under the current Obamacare system for not getting health insurance. Under our plan, you have that option to do that. You have, so you're not required to do that. So the numbers with CBO that you just referenced, a lot of those are taking into account young people that may not choose to or may not want to participate in healthcare except for catastrophic or if they have high-risk conditions or pre-existing conditions, I should say. So that's part of the numbers. But there is no doubt, I will tell you this, Willis, we have to make sure that we don't pull the rug out from anybody that has pre-existing conditions, that has a healthcare plan now that they rely on. But I think a lot of those numbers relate to younger people being involved. But I look at this as the start of the process. This will be open. It will be transparent. I don't anticipate that we'll have a vote on this for 2 or 3 weeks, maybe longer on that. We're going through the committee process. I think this bill will be amended, changed, and revised. And the last thing I will say, I don't look at this as a partisan issue. If you remember during the presidential race, you know, Hillary Clinton talked about fixing, revising, amending Obamacare. Both sides agree that we need to fix the current system to bring down costs.
You talk about enrollment. Let's talk a little bit about how that affects the risk pool. Isn't that going to affect the risk pool, more healthy Americans foregoing insurance, worsening the risk pool and causing the premiums to go up?
Well, one part of this proposed bill put forth is giving more discretion to the states and relieving the burden on the federal government. Many of the states across the country have been very creative, and they've been very successful in setting up high-risk pooling when it comes to pre-existing conditions or people that have health care that costs a lot of money. And so I think as you push more of these things to the states, I think that will give them an opportunity, depending on what state you're in, to be a part of a program that is a better-funded program, more fiscally sound. And frankly, that's what a lot of the governors have asked for, is more discretion when it comes to health care. Now, the problem with that is, Willis, sometimes you'll have a state that maybe isn't the best run state. And Illinois probably falls into that category because we haven't had a budget in 2 years. But there is definitely an emphasis on pushing that to the states to give them more flexibility and more discretion in implementing, you know, many of these programs.
Let's take a look at what some other Republicans are saying. Congressman Rob Whitman of Virginia said, "It is clear that this bill is not consistent with the repeal and replace principles for which I stand. I do not think this bill will do what it is necessary for the short and long-term best interests of the people in Virginia." And Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas has asked House members not to walk the plank for a bill and put the House majority at risk for a bill that doesn't have a chance. So I assume that you disagree with these people, since you term this bill a good first step.
Well, I would mention a couple things. I think Tom Cotton doesn't think it's conservative enough. He thinks you ought to gut Medicaid and not have any tax credits. So, I mean, I would agree with you, Willis. There are people on the far right, which I would put Tom Cotton in. The reason why he doesn't like the bill is it doesn't go, it's not conservative enough. And I think Whitman would be on the other side of that. But clearly you're going to have disagreements. This is a complicated, nuanced issue. And you're going to have different opinions on both sides. But in public, in this situation, as I go back to my earlier point, if we do nothing, Obamacare collapses. The trajectory that we are on, it's not fiscally sustainable, so we have to fix it. My point is, Willis, we have to look at what's worked in Obamacare, a couple of those things I mentioned, and how do we fix that? And remember, Obamacare took 3 years to implement from the time it was introduced till the time it was fully implemented. It took 3 years. This is going to take a little time to do, but I think if we go in with the goals of keeping the things that work, but also changing, reforming, making it more effective and efficient, I think we have the ability to do that and do that in a bipartisan way.
Congressman Darren LaHood is on the phone from Washington. I'm Willis Kern, and this is Sound Ideas on GLT. You talk about a timetable. The bill has already passed two committees, this bill that was proposed in the past few days in the House. It is scheduled for a floor vote. There were 15 months of deliberations before Obamacare came up for a vote. So what is the hurry here? Does a bill such as far-reaching as this deserve some more scrutiny?
Well, I think we are going through the process of scrutiny. This was obviously a huge issue, not only in the presidential race, but in the election last year. But I also think, Willis, I mean, this was one of the issues that Republicans ran on, that President Trump ran on as candidate Trump at the time. And one thing, I think people want us to fulfill the campaign promises. But remember, this got introduced last Monday, a week ago yesterday. It went through the Energy and Commerce Committee, the Ways and Means Committee. This week it's going to go through the Budget Committee. Next week it's going to go through the Rules Committee. Again, open, transparent process. And that's just the House side. Hadn't got to the Senate yet. The other thing to remember, Willis, is, again, I wasn't in Congress at the time, but when Obamacare passed on Christmas Eve, Nancy Pelosi had the famous line, let's pass it and then we'll read it later. That is not the process we're going through. I think the process thus far has been transparent. It's been open. I think when it gets to the House floor, there will be a number of amendments that will be able to be offered to, again, fix, revise, change that. And I'm looking forward to seeing how that plays out and how we can improve the bill.
Well, the only proposal we have right now is the one that's before us, so that's the only one we can really discuss. And it rolls back taxes for the wealthiest Americans who help pay for the ACA and rolls back the benefits to the middle and working class Americans to buy insurance. Is this helpful and is it fair?
Well, I would mention a couple things. If you think about it, in our population in the United States, about 150, 160 million people get their health insurance through their companies that they are employed by or their businesses. For the vast majority, a switch to this plan is not going to affect them. It is going to affect other people in our society. But again, when I talk about premiums going up and deductibles going way up, what this plan will do will relieve some of that burden to drive down premiums. Again, if you talk to businesses, you talk to people at the Chamber of Commerce, small and medium-sized businesses, they want relief. I think there's a combination of things that we can do to drive down those costs. I don't look at this as a tax cut for wealthy people. Talk to any small or medium-sized business in McLean County. They're going to get a break, but those aren't wealthy people. Those are people in the middle class that employ people every day, and this is going to give them some relief. And I think it is a fine line, Willis, between finding that sweet spot of, you know, reform and efficiencies that are good and keeping in place what's worked.
And you mentioned Medicaid a little bit ago. Let's take a look at one provision of this particular proposal, which block grants Medicaid back to the states. Why won't this result in unequal care from state to state? And do you have any confidence that states like Illinois, you already mentioned 2 years without a budget, are equipped to administer Medicaid?
Well, again, Medicaid has exploded exponentially across the country. It has in Illinois, and it's tripled since Bill Clinton was president. I think Medicaid, for what it was originally intended to, we should fulfill that. We should fund that. We have an obligation to do that for the working poor, for children of the poor. That has to be there. I support that 100%. I think where you run into a problem, Willis, is when you have able-bodied working men that qualify for Medicaid. I think you've got to figure out a way to transition them to work rather than relying on Medicaid. And it's also worth noting, Willis, that only half of the states accepted the Medicaid exchange when that was put forth. For instance, Wisconsin didn't accept it, Tennessee didn't, Texas didn't, about half the states did. Illinois did under Governor Pat Quinn at the time. Set up these exchanges. So there's a differing view across the country, but there is no doubt when you look at changing the parameters of Medicaid, and by the way, this bill says anybody that's currently enrolled in Medicaid, it gets to stay in Medicaid, gets that funding. This changes as of 2019. I think that's a fair way to look at that. Moving forward.
And let's talk a little bit more about campaign promises. President Trump campaigned that everyone would be covered. So how does this bill fulfill that promise? And what role do you expect President Trump in helping to shape this bill so that it accomplishes that?
Well, Everybody will cover it in the sense that, I'll go back to what I said before, the mandate currently that young people have to sign up or they get fined, right, that mandate, everyone will have the availability of health care to sign up. But if you're a young person and you don't want to, for whatever reason, your choice, your freedom to decide, whatever that is, and that goes for other people, you are gonna, you have that option to not get health insurance. But you're not going to be denied because of pre-existing conditions. You're not going to be denied because you're not denied from your parents' insurance. If you're, you know, 24, 25, 26, you're going to be able to have insurance through them. So that keeps that safety net in place. But so you will have the availability of health insurance. But if people don't want to do that, they're not going to be forced to do it like we do currently under the plan.
And President Trump said that there would be a bloodbath in 2018 if Congress didn't repeal and replace Obamacare. Is there any concern that there will be an upheaval in the Senate and the House if as many as 24 million people lose their coverage, as the CBO says about this bill?
Well, I'm not going to get into hypotheticals. We have a job to do, what we were elected to do. The president has a job to do. I mean, governing is hard, right? And now we have an obligation to the people we represent to work in a bipartisan way to fix this law. Again, I've stressed this in every interview I've given. Obamacare is going to collapse. It's going to fail. And in some ways, the easy thing would be is to sit back and say, we told you so, and have it collapse. But we can't do that. And so I think I know we have an obligation to fix this. And what happens in 2018, we can't look at the next election. We have to look at how we fix this plan. That's what's in front of us right now. We just got elected in November and got sworn in January.
We received more than 70 questions on our Facebook page, and I want to get to some of those, run those past you. Rebecca Fortner says she received an answer to a survey from you regarding the ACA, and she assumes many others did as well. How much, if at all, will constituent opinion factor into your decision regarding the replacement bill, and what were the highlights of those survey results, and should she have bothered to answer it?
Absolutely. Getting feedback from my 710,000 constituents is vital to this process. I look at every one of the surveys that comes back into my office. I read the letters, the emails, the comments on Facebook. Absolutely. Now, that doesn't mean I'm always going to agree with people, Willis. I got a very diverse district of 710,000 people. But what I promise to do is engage in dialogue, listen to everybody in my district. This is part of our democratic system. And make decisions based on what's in the best interest of our constituency. And as I said before, engaging my constituency, people, there's views on all sides, right? People complain all the time about the high cost of healthcare. Why are my deductibles going up to $4,000, $5,000, $6,000? You know, why do I have premiums going up 55% in my district? So it goes back and forth on that, but. I encourage people all the time to engage with our office and with me, and I try to do that every time that I come back every single weekend. My last break, I did over 25 public events throughout my district, talked about healthcare at a lot of those. Again, this is a controversial issue, but engagement, dialogue is important to this process.
Well, you have these campaign events for sure, and the overriding topic among the questions that we received on our Facebook page had to deal with the idea and the concept of face-to-face town halls. And many people wanted to know, when was your last face-to-face town hall meeting in the district? And separate from the campaign events, why are town hall meetings any different than those campaign events?
Well, I will tell you this. I've had four elections in 16 months. In the last 6 months, I've done 250 public events throughout my district and talked about health care. I did a bunch of debates last year in this process. So, anybody that wants to come meet with me at my office, I'm happy to do that. I will just tell you, Willis, my last break in Peoria, I had about 15 protesters outside of my office. I invited every single one of them into my office that day. We sat around a table and talked about this. The next time we're back on break in April, I'm considering a number of events being town hall meetings. If we can structure those in a very a civil manner, I'm not going to engage with people that are going to yell and scream and play the gotcha game. But people that want to have a dialogue and discussion, I will do that every single day. That I'm back in my district, even if you don't agree with me. That's part of our system and our democracy, and I will continue to do that.
So is it safe to say then that there will be some sort of town hall meeting with members of your constituency in the 18th district in the month of April?
As long as it is set up the right way and we have people that are willing to engage in constructive dialogue and to have a meeting that is not does not digress into disobedience and playing that gotcha game, I'm happy to do that, and we're entertaining that right now.
And I'm sure you've heard of the group Indivisible 18. They say they have met with your staff, and they've talked about a civil, moderated town hall. Is that the kind of thing you're talking about, meeting with these people and others?
I think when we talk about a civil, moderated, good discussion, absolutely. Those are the type of things that I've continued to engage in and will. I will also mention to you, Willis, I had a 2 weeks ago in Jacksonville, I had a meeting before the Chamber of Commerce. The woman that's the number one advocate against the ACA, probably the number one protester in my district, she was in the meeting and with a number of other people to engage. And I listened to every question she asked me. Now, that doesn't mean we agreed on everything, but giving her a forum and a dialogue, that's part of what I will continue to do. And that was done in a civil way. The more we can do things like that in a forum, I'm happy to do it.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Willis Kernan. We're speaking with 18th District Congressman Darren LaHood. Should President Trump apologize to former President Obama for the unfounded allegations regarding wiretapping? And is that how this should work? Unfounded allegations that get a full House and Senate investigation? If there's no evidence of wiretapping, should it go that far?
I think it's a distraction. I don't think we should be focused on issues like that unless you have sound evidence on that. So that's not something I'm supportive of. I don't think, frankly, I don't think we should be talking about those things if there isn't proof and evidence of that. I spent 10 years as a state and federal prosecutor. I think it's a distraction. We ought to focus on the big issues that people want us to work on together in a bipartisan way.
National Security Advisor Flynn resigned over contacts with the Russian government. It looks as though now Attorney General Jeff Sessions, acting as a campaign surrogate, met with the Russian ambassador and wasn't truthful about it during his confirmation hearing. What role should the House play in getting to the bottom of the contact and its impact in Russian meddling in the U.S. election?
Both the Senate and the House Intelligence Committees have opened investigations related to this. I am fully supportive of that. These are bipartisan committees. They have begun their work on doing this investigation, and I want to see what their conclusion and their summary is. And if that summary and conclusion leads us to firm evidence, then I think we have to go to the next step in terms of finding out whether there was any criminal culpability there. But let's let the investigative bodies in the House and Senate in a bipartisan way do their work.
President Trump's been in office now for pretty close to 60 days. What grade do you give him?
Well, I would give his speech that he gave to the State of the Union an A, or I guess the joint session of Congress. I thought his speech was an A. I thought he hit a home run. And the reason why I think that, Willis, is he acted presidential. He laid out a firm vision. It was an hour-long speech. He was very serious. He was measured. He talked about the substantive issues that matter. And I thought that was the right tone and the right way to approach governing. I wish he wouldn't tweet as much. I wish he wouldn't engage in a number of these other things that I think are irrelevant to the purpose of governing. So, I mean, I give him mixed reviews. But again, the more he can act presidential and serious in this job, the better. I will also say I give him very high marks for his nomination of Gorsuch for the Supreme Court. I don't think you'll find a more qualified person than Judge Neil Gorsuch. And so I give him high marks for that. I give him high marks for the cabinet he's put together. Many people from outside of government that come from the private sector that have been successful that differ from him on some views. But I think the cabinet he's put in place is a pretty powerful group that is based on substance and merit. So I give him high grades on that. Again,
high grades for Tillerson and DeVos.
Well, I think if you look at Tillerson and you look at the fact that he has been a real diplomat around the world in his work for ExxonMobil, and look at the people. Bob Gates is somebody I have an awful lot of respect for. He worked for President Obama as his defense secretary and also for President Bush. He's the one that gave the name to Trump. People like that I have a lot of respect for. Condoleezza Rice supports Tillerson. DeVos, I don't know as much about her because I have not met her or been around her, Willis, so I'm going to reserve judgment on her moving forward.
All right, Congressman, we had an unprecedented response on our Facebook page when we posted that we'd be talking to you today and asked for some questions. We only scratched the surface. Can you pledge to us that you'll stay engaged with GLT? We'd like to talk to you again very soon, hopefully.
Willis, I enjoyed the interview. I thought your questions were very balanced, and I look forward to coming back on with you again and continuing to stay engaged.
All right, Congressman, thanks for your time today. U.S. Representative Darren LaHood represents the 18th Congressional District of the state of Illinois. I'm Willis Kern.